made windows and was available only in black. But it was cheap. Ford's own line workers could purchase one with savings from the remarkably high wages Ford paid. Partly to prevent unionization and partly to attract the best workforce in Michigan, Ford introduced the $5-a-day wage in 1914. This was nearly double what his most generous competitors paid, and it cut the legs out from under the union. Yet even at these wages, Ford drove down the price to $345 in 1916. The automaker's personal life was more complex than the design of the Tin Lizzie, however. Famous for saying, "History is bunk," Ford actually spent millions of dollars collecting and preserving historical artifacts. And he could be a master of the gaff. While making a speech at Sing Sing Prison in New York, Ford opened by saying, "Boys, I'm glad to see you here." But as an internationalist utopian in the mold of Alfred Nobel, Ford put his money where his mouth was, financing a peace ship in 1915 to haul himself and other peace activists to Germany to instruct Kaiser Wilhelm to call off the war. His anti-Semitism was well known, and to his great discredit, he financed an anti-Jewish newspaper in Detroit, to which he frequently contributed. After Adolf Hitler came to power in Germany, Ford expressed admiration for Der Führer, who supposedly had a picture of the American on his wall. At the same time Henry Ford struggled with the automobile, another fantastic machine appeared on the scene when two bicycle manufacturers from Dayton, Ohio, Wilbur and Orville Wright, sought to use the laws of aerodynamics to produce machine-powered, human-controlled flight at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. Although the Wright brothers' maiden voyage on December 17, 1903, lasted just 12 seconds and covered only 120 feet, you could have thrown a ball farther. It displayed the possibility of conquering air itself to the world. The flight proved highly embarrassing to the U.S. government, which through the Army had given seed money to a similar program under the direction of Samuel P. Langley. But Langley's government-funded aircraft crashed ignominiously, and after the Wright brothers' success, he stood to lose his funding. He therefore claimed that the Wright brothers' flight had not been powered flight at all, but gliding. The Wrights contributed to the suspicion with their secrecy about the designs, fearing patent infringements of the type that had afflicted Whitney. Already, Glenn Curtis and others had taken elements of the Wright Flyer and applied them to their own craft. Thus, the Wrights hesitated to publicly display the aircraft and, for several years, to conduct highly visible trials. President Roosevelt intervened to settle the issue, insisting on a carefully monitored test in which Langley was proven wrong and the Wrights right. In a 1908 summer flight at Le Mans, France, Wilbur flew an airplane for an hour and a half, covering more than 40 miles. Le Figaro, France's premier newspaper, gushed that it had witnessed Wilbur Wright and his great white bird, the beautiful mechanical bird. There is no doubt, Wilbur and Orville Wright have well and truly flown. Convinced, in 1909, the Army gave the Wright brothers a contract for $30,000 per machine. The auto and the airplane were still in their infancy, and only the most eccentric dreamers could envision an America crisscrossed by thousands of miles of asphalt and dotted by hundreds of airports. Dreamers of another sort remained hard at work, though, in the realm of social engineering. Progressive reformers. While the Wright brothers aspired to reach the heavens, quite literally, through technology, another movement sought the kingdom of heaven through more spiritual means. Revivals, of course, had played a prominent role in the first and second Great Awakenings of the colonial era and Jacksonian periods. Following in the paths blazed by evangelists such as Charles G. Finney and holiness leader Charles Parnham, evangelists routinely hit the dusty trails to rouse the morally sleeping masses for the Lord. In the late 1800s, many Americans had adopted either a more formal liturgical stance aligned with the major traditional churches or had joined the growing sea of secularists. But in 1905, spiritual shockwaves hit Los Angeles, spread from a revival in Wales. The Welsh revival was so powerful that the number of drunkenness arrests fell over a 3-year period, and the miners cleaned up their language so much that their horses reportedly could no longer understand the commands. The revival reached the United States through traveling ministers to the American holiness churches, where a number of prophecies foretold a massive revival that would descend on California. A year later, in April 1906, at a church on Azusa Street in Los Angeles, as Elder William Seymour began praying with local church members, the Azusa Christians began to speak in other tongues, technically called glossolalia. This was a biblical phenomenon that occurred at Pentecost when the Holy Spirit filled the believers, and at that time they spoke in other tongues, that is, they spoke in languages they did not know. Crowds packed the area around the house, growing so large that the foundation of the front porch collapsed. Eventually, the prayer services, which by now were going on for 24 hours a day, had to be moved to an old African Methodist Episcopal, AME Church, nearby. As word of the Azusa Street revival spread, it became clear that this was an interracial event, often with women conducting important parts of the services or prayers. Inevitably, divisions and schisms appeared, and some of the early members left or otherwise lost their influence, until finally between 1909 and 1913, depending on whether one counts a second revival that occurred at the same location, the revival ended. The Azusa Street revival gave birth to the modern charismatic Pentecostal movement in America, setting the spiritual stage for dozens of charismatic denominations in the United States. An even larger movement, that of the social gospel, sprang from mainstream Protestant ministers who emphasized social justice over perfecting the inner man and the relationship of Christians to others in society. Social gospel advocates included Washington Gladden, an Ohio congregational minister, Walter Rauschenbusch, a New York Baptist preacher, and Kansan Charles Sheldon, whose In His Steps sold 23 million copies. Most social gospelers endorsed minimum wage and child labor laws, favored a redistribution of wealth, and generally embraced state regulation of business. To do so usually involved significant revisions of the Bible, and many, though not all, social gospelers abandoned any claims about Scripture's literal accuracy. Instead, the social gospelers viewed the Bible as a moral guidebook, but no more than that. These modernists also abandoned theological dogmatism for greater tolerance of other faiths. Secularist reformers continued the quest for perfectionism with something like a religious zeal. They wielded great influence in the first decade of the new century. By 1912, progressives found adherents in both political parties and had substantial support from women, who supported health and safety laws and prohibition and temperance legislation. In turn, women's suffrage became a centerpiece of all progressive reform. Theodore Roosevelt had done much to dull the campaign issues of food and drug reform and trust busting. Individual states initiated many progressive ideas for direct election of judges, popular initiative for legislation that the state assembly did not wish to bring up, public referenda on unpopular bills advanced by the legislatures, and recall of public officials. Indeed, Arizona's statehood had been held up until 1912 because its constitution had all these features. Reform impulse sprang up as much in the West as in the big cities of the East. Arizona, California, Nevada, Oregon, Washington, New Mexico, Texas, Kansas, Montana, Wyoming, Utah, Idaho, Oklahoma, and South Dakota all had enacted woman suffrage by 1919. Progressive ideas were in the air everywhere. From Virginia to Wisconsin, professional city managers replaced city councils, and new campaigns to reform government swept from South Dakota to Texas. There was a certain illogic to the whole reform mentality. Full-time career politicians were venal and thus needed to be replaced with professional managers. But professional managers were also untrustworthy because they wanted the job in the first place. Jefferson and Madison's dream of part-time citizen legislators who would convene at the Capitol, do their business, and then go home to their constituents, under assault since the Jacksonian party system, now yielded further to demands for the professionalization of politics. This professionalization hardly eliminated corruption. Rather, it changed the names of those controlling the graft. Under ordinary circumstances, immigrants were the object of considerable pandering, but election days brought even more extreme treatment for those who had newly arrived on American shores. Bosses trucked the immigrants to polls and paid them to vote for the machine. When possible, party loyalists voted multiple times, honoring Tweed's maxim to vote early and often. Supporters stuffed ballot boxes with the names of dead voters, wrote in fictitious residents, or, conversely, helped lose ballot boxes from areas where the opposing party might do well. Secret ballots, of course, undercut this power by hampering vote buying and also by preventing illiterate citizens from voting, since they could no longer take a colored card that indicated party preference, but had to actually read a ballot. All the while, a climate of violence and larceny, and not surprisingly, organized crime, hovered around the perimeter of political machines, occasionally swooping in to grab a contract or blackmail an official. Every ethnic group in a large city had its own mob. The Italian mafia was merely the most notorious of these. The Irish, Jews, and, in subsequent decades, blacks, Puerto Ricans, Chinese, and Jamaicans had gangs. And every gang battled every other, often in bloody shootouts. Corruption filtered down into police departments, where being on the take was viewed as a legitimate bonus as long as it did not interfere with prosecuting real criminals. Law enforcement officials routinely winked at brothels, gambling rooms, even opium dens, as long as the users remained blissfully pacific, in return for payola envelopes that appeared in the officers' coat pockets during their daily rounds. In 1911, the Chicago Metropolitan Vice Commission conducted a thorough study of prostitution, which shocked the investigators. At least 5,000 full-time prostitutes worked the city, one for every 200 women in Chicago. Although that number, the commission estimated, might have represented a conservative guess that did not include so-called clandestine prostitutes, such as married women making part-time money. Equally stunning, the prostitution business, when counting procurers, pimps, tavern owners, thugs, and crime lords who ran the districts, probably generated upward of $15 million in annual revenues. Had the money stayed only with the criminals, it would have been easier to deal with. But as the commission reported, the graft was so widespread that prostitution income found its way into the hands not only of the owners of the bordellos, but also of the police, judges handling the cases, and politicians appointing the judges. Progressive-era reformers tried to remedy such social ills and vices through education, their most valued weapon. Public education in such areas as hygiene, they contended, would solve the problem of venereal disease and alcoholism. Only a few groups, such as the Catholic Church, pointed out that a wide gap existed between education and morality, or that secular knowledge did not equate with spiritual wisdom. Reformers silenced those voices with ridicule and embarrassment. Reformers such as Jane Addams firmly believed all urban dwellers should conform to certain progressive ideals regarding living spaces, clean and not too crowded, personal behavior, eschewing hard liquor, prostitution, gambling, and other vices, and civic equality. Women should vote and be educated. The fact that they were imposing what were, in reality, upper-class values on people who did not have the means to maintain them did not stop the reformers. Adams, a prominent progressive and founder of Hull House, a settlement house for the poor in Chicago, eventually embraced the spectrum of progressive ideas, including woman suffrage and pacifism. As with her fellow progressives, she believed redemption came not through religion, but through social action, often mandated by government. Social activists found that they needed more than good intentions to gain the upper ground in the reform debates. They needed an aura of expertise. Consequently, intellectuals and academics appropriated the concept of professionalism and special insight based on science and numbers, and now they applied a strange twist. To claim superior understanding of urban issues, reformers could not rely on established fields of learning, so they created entirely new subjects in which they could claim mastery. These social sciences, by their very name, asserted scientific explanations for human behavior. The new social scientists found that if, in addition to numbers, they could invoke esoteric and virtually indecipherable theories, their claims to special insight became even more believable. Many Americans would dismiss them immediately as cranks, while some, especially the elites and other intellectuals, would find them to be on the cutting edge and revolutionary and would feed their ideas back into the system. Thorsten Veblen was one of the first sociologists to emerge from the new disciplines. Writing A Theory of the Leisure Class, 1899, a predictably anti-business book, Veblen proposed a new economic system in which power would reside in the hands of highly trained engineers, including, one suspects, himself. Famous, or perhaps notorious, for his theory of conspicuous consumption, Veblen viewed the economic world as a zero-sum scenario, in which one person's consumption decreased the amounts of goods available to someone else. In that sense, he reinforced the positions of progressive social scientists who sought to use science to bolster their anti-vice crusades. Social scientists managed to exert great influence on lower levels of society by inserting progressive views of morality and behavior into the public education system through the social hygiene movement. Who, after all, could oppose cleanliness and good health? And whom better to target than children? Cleaning up individual morality still took a back seat to the central task of eliminating corruption of the city and state governments. Obsessed with perfecting the political system at all levels, progressives were responsible for the bookends that touched on each end of reform. The first, the income tax, represented a continued irrational antipathy toward wealthy Americans. Hostility toward the rich had characterized the populists' platforms and had never completely disappeared after the 1890s. The interesting twist now was that guilty progressive elites sought to take wealth from other non-progressive elites by appealing to still other strata in society. Concerns over inequities in wealth distribution and banking reform were the central features of the progressives' agenda. The second, temperance, which had receded temporarily as an issue after the Civil War, found renewed interest in the early 20th century. In the 1960s, former Alabama Governor George Wallace, running as a third-party candidate, complained that there wasn't a dime's worth of difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. He would have been right in 1912, when not one and not two, but all three of the major candidates to one degree or another embraced the agenda of progressivism. The incumbent William Howard Taft, the Democratic challenger Woodrow Wilson, and the former president Theodore Roosevelt, now an insurgent seeking to unseat Taft, all professed their belief in strong antitrust actions, tariff reform, direct taxation, and more equitable wealth distribution. Of the three, Wilson, perhaps, was the most idealistic, but given the nature of progressivism itself, all three suffered from a skepticism of free markets and an affinity for government intervention in public health. Roosevelt held the key to the election. No successor would have satisfied him. Theodore Rex, as one recent biographer called him, had an ego that precluded yielding the spotlight. Few leaders inherently combined such raw frontier aggressiveness with an upper-class progressive reform mentality. Roosevelt was a fusion of human diversity as opposite as John Wayne was from Ralph Nader. Certainly Taft, despite his intention to continue TR's progressive agenda, could not measure up. Roosevelt was at his best when campaigning against something or someone, even if it was his own successor. He selected Taft as his heir, then ran off to Africa on safari, only to be hunted down himself by Pinchot and other malcontents who disliked the new president. Within 2 years of anointing Taft, Roosevelt had second thoughts. The president had a poor public image despite an activist agenda that would have made even Roosevelt blanch. He had brought 80 antitrust suits compared to TR's 25 and declared more lands for public use, that is, yanking them from the private sector, than Roosevelt. Many Republicans, however, disliked Taft, partly out of his sour relations with Congress, partly out of a concern for his weak public image, but most of all because he was not Roosevelt. Consequently, a group of Republican leaders contacted Roosevelt about running in the 1912 election, which the former president greeted with his characteristic toothy smile. Roosevelt planned to enter the primaries, gaining enough convention delegates to wrest the nomination from the incumbent Taft. Party hierarchies, though, do not embrace change any more readily than the professional business managers on whom they pattern themselves. Unpopular incumbents, whether Taft in 1912, Hoover in 1932, or Ford in 1976, generally maintain sufficient control over the machinery of the party to prevent a coup, no matter how attractive the alternative candidate. Roosevelt should have recalled his own dominance of the procedures in 1904, when he had quashed an insurgent movement to replace him at the top of the ticket. Taft's men knew the same tricks. TR needed only 100 votes to win the nomination, but it may as well have been 1,000. The Taft forces controlled the procedures, and the president emerged as the party's nominee. Unwilling to bow out gracefully, Roosevelt declared war on Taft, forming his own new party, the Progressive Party, which had as its logo the bull moose. Roosevelt invoked thoroughly progressive positions, moving to the left of Taft by advocating an income tax and further regulation of business. This not only stole votes that normally would have gone to Taft, but it also allowed Democrat Woodrow Wilson to appear more sensible and moderate. Roosevelt won 4.1 million votes and 88 electoral college votes compared to 3.4 million for Taft and 8 electoral votes. This gave Wilson an electoral victory despite taking only 6.2 million popular votes, 45% of the total, a number lower than any other victorious president since Lincoln had won with less than half the country in 1860. TR effectively denied the White House to Taft, allowing the second Democrat since Reconstruction to be elected president. An ominous note was sounded by the candidacy of the avowed socialist Eugene V. Debs, who received nearly 1 million votes. Uniting anarchists, populists, Grangers, and single taxers, the Socialist Party had witnessed a rapid growth, from 10,000 in 1901 to 58,000 in 1908, to its peak of just under 1 million votes, or 6% of the total vote cast in the 1912 election. Debs, whom fellow socialist Margaret Sanger once dubbed a silly silk hat radical, was the glue that held together the disparate groups. Despite their meteoric rise, however, the socialists flattened out against the hard demands of industry in World War I. One could not miss the contrast of the American election, where the winner had only a plurality and where there was no challenge whatsoever to the legitimacy of the election, with the events in Spain the same year, where not one but two prime ministers in succession were assassinated, or in Paraguay, where two successive presidents were overthrown in coups, one hunted down and killed. Or in neighboring Mexico, where Francisco Madero overthrew President Porfirio Diaz, but who held on for 2 years before being overthrown by Victoriano Huerta. In short, America's remarkable stability and willingness to peacefully abide by the lawful results of elections was a glaring exception to the pattern seen in most of the world. Woodrow Wilson was a throwback in many ways to the old Van Buren ideal, or rather the reverse of it, a Southern man of Northern principles. Born in 1856, Wilson grew up in Georgia, where he saw the Civil War firsthand as a boy. His Presbyterian minister father sent Woodrow to Princeton, then to the University of Virginia Law School, then to Johns Hopkins, where he earned a doctorate. Throwing himself into academia, Wilson became a political science professor at Princeton, then in 1902, its president. His 1889 book, The State, adopted a strangely Darwinian view of government. He called for regulation of trade and industry, regulation of labor, care of the poor and incapable, sumptuary laws, as well as prohibition laws. With great pride, Wilson observed that government did whatever experience permits or the times demand, and he advocated a middle ground between individuals and socialism. Wilson argued that all combination, emphasis added, which leads to monopoly, must be under the direct or indirect control of society. Both Wilson's progressive positions and his prominent place at Princeton made him a prime prospect for the New Jersey governorship, which he won in 1910 on a platform of ending corruption in state government. By the time he ran for president in 1912, Wilson could claim roots in both the South and North, blending the two under the banner of progressive idealism. Wilsonian Progressivism. Timing is a large part of any presidency. Presidents receive credit for programs long underway before their arrival, or pay the penalty for circumstances they inherit. As a progressive president, Wilson benefited from ideas already percolating through the system, including the income tax and reform of the national banking system. This 1-2 punch, it could be argued, did more to fundamentally reorder American economic life than any other package of legislation passed any time thereafter, including the New Deal and Great Society programs. Both received the enthusiastic support of Wilson's Secretary of the Treasury, William Gibbs McAdoo, who helped craft the banking reform, which he called a blow in the solar plexus of the money monopoly. A Georgia populist progressive lawyer, McAdoo stood firmly on the side of reform, whether it was food and product safety, taxing, or banking. And as a Southerner, he bridged the old Confederacy gap by invoking the name of Lincoln favorably while touting Wilson as a Southerner. However, he abandoned states' rights entirely by hastening the transfer of financial power from New York to Washington through both taxation and banking policies. America's banking system had suffered criticism since the Civil War. It was too elastic. It was not elastic enough. It was too centralized in New York. It was not centralized enough in New York. For 20 years, it had seemed that the colossus J.P. Morgan alone might carry the nation's banking community on his shoulders like Atlas. He did so in 1893, then again in 1907, at which time he announced that even with support from other syndicate members, including some foreign bankers, the next panic would sink him and the country. Consequently, by the turn of the century, most of the so-called bank reformers, including numerous bankers from the Midwest who feared for their own smaller institutions if large East Coast banks got into trouble, agreed on three main principles for shoring up the system. First, genuine bank reform needed, in their view, to fill the void left by the old BUS as a central bank. Never mind that the BUS had never fulfilled that function. Collective memory inaccurately said that the bank had restrained the inflationary impulses of the state banks, and thus provided a crucial check on the system in times of stress. The new central bank, above all, should be a lender of last resort. That is, it should provide cash, liquidity, when there were isolated bank runs. Second, bank reformers concluded that an elastic money supply was needed in which credit and cash could expand in good times and contract in bad. This was a main complaint about the money supply under the National Bank Act, that the national banks lacked the ability to rapidly issue new banknotes or any mechanism for withdrawing them from circulation. Of course, any elastic powers would centralize even further the money supply in the hands of one source, as opposed to the many national banks who each issued their own notes, providing some tiny measure of competition. Third, all but a few of the most conservative East Coast bankers wanted to reduce the power of New York's financial community. A certain element of anti-Semitism accompanied this, because the phrase New York bankers was really code for New York Jewish bankers. It regurgitated the old fears of the Rothschilds and their world money power. But even well-meaning Midwestern bankers looked suspiciously at the influence Eastern banking houses had over affairs in Kansas or Colorado. It seemed unfair to them that an East Coast panic could close banks in Littletown or Salina. Critics noted another problem, namely that national banks could not just print money willy-nilly. To expand the number of notes they issued, the national banks had to purchase additional U.S. government bonds, a process that could take several months. Certainly, the structure did not enhance elasticity. On the other hand, states permitted branch banking, which enhanced stability and solvency, whereas national banks were denied branching privileges. The entire banking structure still relied on gold as a reserve. For gold to effectively police international transactions, all nations had to abide by the rules of the game. If one nation had a trade deficit with another, it would make up the difference in gold. But this meant a decrease in that nation's gold reserve, in turn decreasing the amount of money issued by that nation's central bank, causing a recession. As prices fell, the terms of trade would then swing back in that country's favor, whereupon gold would flow in and the cycle would reverse. The difficulty with the gold standard was not financial, but political. A nation in recession always had an incentive to go off the gold standard. However, from 1900 to 1912, most nations faithfully submitted to the discipline of gold in a time of prosperity. Such false optimism cloaked the fact that when the pressure of national recessions began, the temptation would be for each country to leave the gold standard before another. In the meantime, however, it reinforced the desire on the part of American reformers to create a financial system with a central bank along the lines of the European model. Following the many plans and proposals drawn up by bankers' organizations over the previous 30 years, in November 1910, five men met in secrecy on Jekyll Island, Georgia, to design a new financial system for the nation. Frank Vanderlip, president of National City Bank, Paul Warburg, a powerful partner in Kuhn, Loeb & Company, Henry Davison, a partner in the Morgan Bank, Harvard professor A. Pyatt Andrew, and Senator Nelson Aldrich of Rhode Island outlined the plan that became the Federal Reserve System. They presented their completed plan to Congress, where it stagnated. Many viewed it as too centralized, and others complained that it did not deal with the money power of New York's banks. Meanwhile, the House held hearings in 1912 that dragged J.P. Morgan and other prominent bankers before the Banking and Currency Committee. Morgan was accused of consolidation and stifling competition. In fact, Morgan and his contemporaries had strengthened the system and protected depositors by establishing combinations and utilizing clearinghouses, which were private organizations that reduced the likelihood of panics and provided a setting for effective information exchange. House members pontificated about the evils of consolidation. An incredible irony given that in the 1930s, after the Great Depression, another set of congressional investigators would complain that the competitiveness within the securities industry helped cause the stock market crash. Thus, bankers were criticized for competing and criticized for combining. Congressional interest in the Jekyll Island proposal revived, but with emphasis on decentralizing the system and in reducing the influence of New York's banks. The result was the Federal Reserve Act, passed by Congress in 1913. Under the act, 12 Federal Reserve banks would be established across the country, diminishing New York's financial clout. Atlanta, Boston, Dallas, San Francisco, Minneapolis, Chicago, Cleveland, Philadelphia, and Richmond all received Federal Reserve banks, and Missouri got two, St. Louis and Kansas City. Each bank was a corporation owned by the commercial banks in its region and funded by their required deposits. In return, the member banks could borrow from the Reserve Bank in their region. A separate board of governors housed in Washington, D.C., consisting of representatives from each bank, was to set policy. But in reality, each bank tended to go its own way. These characteristics allowed the Federal Reserve System to appear to be independent of the government and nonpartisan. While decentralizing the financial system answered one critical need demanded by the reformers, the Fed, as it became known, also met another in that it served as the lender of last resort. The district banks were to step in during emergencies to rescue failing private banks, but if the crisis grew too severe, one Federal Reserve Bank could obtain help from the Reserve Bank in another region, or all regions if necessary. Few really imagined that even under the new system, there might exist an emergency so broad that every Federal Reserve District would come under siege at the same time. But the reformers had ignored the single most important corrective, introducing interstate branch banking. This disadvantage kept large branch bank systems from becoming member banks, especially A.P. Giannini's powerful Bank of America and Joseph Sartori's First Security Bank and Trust, both in California. To rectify this problem, Congress passed the McFadden Act in 1927, which permitted national banks to have branches in states where the state laws permitted branching, thus allowing both Giannini and Sartori to join the Federal Reserve System as members. But Giannini's dream of nationwide interstate banking was never reached, contributing to the collapse of the banking system during the Great Depression. Contrary to all intentions, the New York Federal Reserve Bank quickly emerged as the most powerful influence in the new Fed system. The creation of the Fed also marked the end of any form of competition in money, since the new Federal Reserve notes eventually replaced money specifically and legally backed by gold or silver. Another pillar of progressivism came to fruition on Wilson's watch. The idea of an income tax had long been cherished by socialists, and it was one of the 10 planks desired by the Communist Party in Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto. During the Civil War, the Republicans had imposed a 3% tax on all incomes over $800, then raised it twice thereafter. Several utopian socialists called for income tax in the post-war years, and both the populists and the Democrats advocated an income tax in the 1890s. But not until 1894 did Congress pass a 2% tax on all incomes above $4,000. Within a year, the Supreme Court struck down the measure as unconstitutional, which it clearly was. For several decades, the tariff and land sales had provided most of the revenue for running the operations of the government, which was adequate as long as the government remained small. However, land sales dwindled in the late 1800s, in no small part because cattle ranchers had succeeded in obtaining grazing rights from the federal government. Over time, the government used that as a means to permanently take the lands off the market. As for tariffs, they carried tremendous political baggage. They pitted one group of Americans against another, usually by section. Northern manufacturers who obtained a tariff on manufactured imports received artificially higher prices for their goods at the expense of all other Americans. Southern sugar planters who obtained a tariff on sugar could raise prices for all sugar consumers, and so on. While some argued that the tariff burdens balanced out, that in one way or another everyone was hurt and everyone benefited, each tariff bill focused on the debate on specific groups who gained and lost. In this regard, the substitution of income taxes for tariffs efficiently conserved legislative energies. Life became simpler for Congress because the battle against tariffs had always involved direct, urgent, and threatening lobbies. The proposed income tax, on the other hand, only affected a small group of the wealthy. Proponents also designed the first proposed tax with two features that would reduce resistance to it. The tax rates would be extremely low, even for wealthy groups, and the filing process would be absurdly simple. Only a few pages were required for the first income tax. Since people had become convinced that equal taxes meant proportional taxes, which was surely untrue, then the income tax promised to equalize tax burdens borne by the various classes and to ensure it was paid by the wealthiest classes. To underscore this fact, the income tax had little to do with revenue and everything to do with reform. There was one small hurdle, the Constitution. Since income taxes were unconstitutional, imposing the new tax demanded the 16th Amendment, which was ratified in 1913. Reformers gained support using three major strategies. One, they emphasized the extremely low nature of the tax and the fact that many Americans would pay no tax at all. Two, they stressed its simplicity. And three, they pointed to the problems and controversies surrounding tariffs. The original tax exempted anyone earning less than $3,000 per year or married couples earning less than $4,000 per year, whereas those earning between $20,000 and $50,000 paid only 2%. For the richest of the rich, those earning over $500,000, the top rate was 7%. Contrasted with taxes in the 21st century, the state tax rates alone in many states exceeds the top rates exacted by the federal government in 1913. Although some liberal historians claimed that the income tax was a conservative measure designed to placate the lower classes with a form of pretend punishment of the rich, it certainly did not help the working man by any stretch of the imagination. By the year 2013, the average American worked until April 18th of every year to pay just his federal taxes, whereas that same American worked only 19 days to purchase all the food he would eat in a year. Income taxes introduced a significant danger to American life, especially through the hidden growth of the federal government. Minor rate changes in the tax would be enacted without any public reaction. During World War II, they were deducted directly from workers' paychecks so that they never saw the damage. Tax Day, April 15th, was almost as far removed from any election as possible to reduce the unpleasant memory of what one paid to the government. Moreover, during an emergency, rate increases became substantial, and even if lowered later, never returned to the pre-emergency levels. A ratchet effect in which government power grew with each crisis. At the end of World War I, the top tax rate would rise by a factor of 10, illustrating the grave danger inherent in the structure. Wilson's reduction of tariff rates was inconsequential and irrelevant after passage of the income tax. He was a big government progressive, and his inclinations were on display in numerous other policies, especially the creation of the Federal Trade Commission, a group appointed by the president to review and investigate business practices. Ostensibly, the FTC was to prevent the formation of monopolistic combinations using its cease and desist orders, augmented by the 1914 Clayton Antitrust Act. A follow-up to the Sherman Antitrust Act, it prohibited interlocking directorates and tying clauses whereby a producer could tie the sale of a desired product it made to another product the buyer did not particularly want. Both the FTC and Clayton, in the truest style of Teddy Roosevelt, targeted big business and trusts. Unfortunately, like taxes, the burden of regulations fell on unintended groups, whereas those usually targeted by the regulations and taxes escaped. Such was the case with the Clayton Act. A study of antitrust laws and their effect on overall business activity revealed that the antitrust actions against large firms coincided with business downturns, suggesting that the downturns resulted from the attacks on a few large firms. These results were repeated in the 1990s when an antitrust suit against Microsoft sparked a massive sell-off in tech stocks, adding support to the argument that antitrust law had done little to encourage competition and had inflicted substantial damage to the U.S. economy for more than a century. While creation of the Fed and the passage of the income tax amendment characterized progressivism at home, events in Mexico gave a brief glimpse of Wilson's vision for progressivism abroad. South of the Border. Even before Wilson assumed office, in 1910, Mexico had entered a period of constant chaos. That year, the Mexican dictator of 33 years, Porfirio Díaz, was overthrown in a coup led by Francisco Madero, ostensibly a Democrat. Within 3 years, however, Madero was in turn unseated by General Victoriano Huerta, who promised a favorable climate for American businesses operating in Mexico. Huerta received support from the U.S. Ambassador Henry Lane Wilson. Aside from the protection of American firms, operations, and personnel, the United States really had little interest in the internal affairs of Mexico. Taft had expressed a willingness to recognize Huerta, but Huerta's forces killed Madero just before Wilson took over, whereupon the president stated that he would not recognize a government of butchers. Wilson's idealism took over as he openly supported Venustiano Carranza and Francisco Pancho Villa, two rebel generals who opposed Huerta. In April 1914, a Mexican officer in Tampico arrested American sailors from the USS Dolphin when they disturbed the public peace on shore leave. When the American naval officers protested, the Mexicans immediately released the sailors, but did not apologize sufficiently to please the admiral. Wilson saw an opportunity to intervene against Huerta. He dispatched a fleet to Veracruz, purportedly to intercept a German vessel delivering munitions to Huerta's army. Events spun out of control, and American warships shelled the city. Carranza soaked all this in and recognized that an overt alliance with Wilson would taint his regime in the eyes of the Mexican people. From that point on, he continued to buy arms from the U.S. government, but he otherwise kept his distance. When the fighting at Veracruz weakened Huerta, Carranza took over in August, then promptly gave the cold shoulder to Wilson's overtures to assist in forming the new Mexican administration. Having failed to woo Carranza, Wilson turned to the other revolutionary general, Villa, whose army held much of northern Mexico. By that time, Villa was something of a celebrity in America, gaining notoriety among journalists and filmmakers as the personification of the New Democrat in Mexico. He was also now Carranza's enemy, and government troops defeated Villa in April 1915, whereupon the rebel leader lost much of his luster. This victory forced Wilson to reconsider Carranza's legitimacy. In frustration, he recognized Carranza as the de facto leader of Mexico without offering official recognition, which in turn outraged the jilted Villa. Seeing his hopes of running Mexico melt away, Villa launched a series of revenge raids directed at Americans across northern Mexico. He killed 17 Americans on a train and then crossed the border in 1916 at Columbus, New Mexico, murdering another 18 U.S. citizens. The president of Mexico lacked the resources as well as the will to pursue Villa in his own territory. Wilson did not. He sent American troops under General John Blackjack Pershing on a punitive expedition into Mexico to capture Villa. Entering Mexico in the spring of 1916 with 4,500 troops, assisted by 10,000 militia securing the border. The expedition also included some unarmored touring cars, 6 reconnaissance aircraft that proved inefficient, and a young cavalry officer named George Patton. Pershing hunted Villa across more than 300 miles of Mexican desert. Although Patton's lead units engaged some of the Villistas, Pershing never truly came close to the main body of Villa's troops, and he finally informed Wilson that the best course of action would be to occupy all of northern Mexico. Wilson publicly insisted his intention was to capture Villa, but privately ordered Pershing to conclude as soon as the Villa band or bands are known to be broken up. The Pershing invasion revived fears of the Colossus of the North again marching on Mexican soil, causing Villa's forces to grow and turning the bloodthirsty killer into a cult hero in parts of Mexico. And while Carranza certainly wanted Villa dead, he did not intend to let the Yankees simply walk into sovereign Mexican territory. In June 1916, Carranza's and Pershing's forces clashed, bringing the two nations to the precipice of war. The president considered Pershing's recommendation for an American occupation of parts of Mexico, and even drafted a message to Congress outlining the proposed occupation, but then scrapped it. With the public's attention increasingly focused on Europe, few people wanted a war with Mexico, especially under such confused circumstances, in which Villa could in no way be viewed as a legitimate agent of the official Mexican government. Given his own culpability in destabilizing the Mexican regime under the guise of promoting democracy, Wilson looked for a graceful exit, agreeing to an international commission to negotiate a settlement. The troops came home from the Mexican desert just in time to board steamers for France. The episode was rife with foreign policy and military lessons for those willing to learn. First, American troops had been committed with no reasonable assurance of achieving their mission, nor was there much public support. Second, Wilson had not exhausted or really even tried other methods to secure the U.S. border against Villa's incursions. Third, by arbitrarily and hastily invading Mexico twice, Wilson turned a natural ally into a wary neighbor. Last, Wilson's insistence on American-style democracy in a primitive country without concurrent supervision through occupation, as in post-World War II Japan or Iraq, was fraught with peril. Mexico did not have fully developed property rights or other essential concepts of government. Wilson did learn some of the lessons. The next time he had to send American forces into foreign lands, it would be for unimpeachable reasons. He kept us out of war. On September 29, 1913, Turkey, Greece, and Bulgaria signed a treaty of peace that many saw as an omen for world amity. Yet over the next year, Europe's diplomats and clear thinkers sank, buried beneath a wave of war mobilizations over which they seemingly had no control. The June 1914 assassination of Austrian Archduke Franz Ferdinand launched these forces on their course. A Serbian nationalist had been blamed for the assassination, although controversy exists as to whether he was a member of the terrorist Black Hand group. Regardless, Austria, with the full support of Germany, immediately moved to retaliate. Serbia invoked a secret agreement with Russia, mobilizing the Russian army, which in turn prompted a reaction from Germany, then a counter-reaction from France, who in turn brought in the British. Within a matter of weeks, the armies of Europe were fully mobilized on enemy borders, trigger fingers itchy, and without any comprehension of why they were going to fight. Germany's Schlieffen Plan, however, demanded that Germany not wait for a full-scale Russian mobilization before striking the Allies. On August 3, 1914, German forces crossed the Belgian border, thereby touching off the Great War. Britain, France, and Russia, called the Triple Entente, or Allies, soon declared war on Germany and Austria-Hungary, soon known as the Central Powers. Before long, a host of second-tier states had been sucked into the war as well, essentially pulling the entire world into the conflict in one form or another. All except the United States. When German guns opened their barrage against Belgium, Wilson warned Americans against that deepest, most subtle, most essential breach of neutrality which may spring out of partisanship, out of passionately taking sides. Roosevelt immediately broke with him, arguing that the nation should take the position of a just man armed, and he wrote angrily of Wilson's reluctance to stand up for the wrongs Belgium had suffered. Wilson instead implored the nation to be neutral in fact as well as name. Already in January 1915, the Central Powers had launched the world's first Zeppelin attacks against England and had finalized plans to cut off Britain's lifeline at sea to the United States. As is often the case, experts on both sides mistakenly foresaw a quick end to the war. British forward observers at Neuve Chapelle were dumbfounded when their initial probing assault, led by 1,000 men, was entirely obliterated. They had another surprise when, in April 1915, the Germans used poison gas for the first time, choking French African troops who could only cough and point to their throats. The British had barely absorbed the threats posed by gas when, in July, the Germans introduced another horror, the flamethrower. The news got worse. Seeking an end run to link up with the Russians and come at the Central Powers from the Black Sea, Britain attempted to break through the Dardanelles Strait. Even the powerful Royal Navy could not punch through the defenses of Germany's allies, the Ottoman Turks. Underestimating the enemy and the geography, the Allies staged a massive invasion of the narrow beaches at Gallipoli, at the foot of the Dardanelles. British, Australian, and New Zealand troops were staggered when, rather than running, the Turks stood their ground to repulse attack after attack up bloody hills. Over a 9-month period, British, French, Australians, and New Zealanders lost 48,000 men, yet gained nothing. Only then did it begin to dawn on the military minds that the machine gun, combined with trench warfare, barbed wire, and long-range artillery, had made the massed infantry charges of the day utterly useless. This was a lesson it had taken the Americans in both the Union Army, Fredericksburg, and Confederate Army, Gettysburg, thousands of battlefield deaths to learn. But finally, the message had sunk in. Battles in Europe soon claimed 500,000 dead and wounded in a single day, then 750,000, then 1,000,000 casualties in battles that lasted weeks over a few acres of ground. British units lost 60% of their officers in a single day's combat. At the Somme, in June 1916, despite the fact that the British fired 250,000 shells at the German trenches, 60 artillery shells every second, 20,000 men and 1,000 officers died in a few hours. Entire companies literally vanished in unending sprays of bullets and shells. The Germans misjudged their enemies even worse than the Allies, predicting that the colonies would rise up, that Ireland would rebel, or that the British population would demand peace at any price. None of that materialized. Next, the Germans expected the Americans to suffer indignity after indignity and gambled that they could kill U.S. citizens, incite Mexico to go to war with the United States, and flagrantly disregard Wilson's repeated warnings. They were wrong about England, and they were wrong about America. Still, after a full year of watching the carnage from afar, Americans shook their heads in wonder. Until May 1915, many still held out hope their nation could avoid taking sides. Wilson even offered to mediate. But forces were already in motion to ensure American entry sooner or later. Germany doubted her high seas fleet could compete with England for control of the oceans, and early on had employed U-boats, submarines, to intercept and destroy trade bound for England. U-boat warfare proved phenomenally effective, if mistake-prone. U-boat captains had difficulty establishing the colors of vessels at sea through their periscopes, and to make matters worse, the British fraudulently flew neutral flags on their own merchantmen, which violated the very essence of neutrality. Before any real enmity could appear between the United States and England over the neutral flag issue, the Germans blundered by sinking the passenger liner Lusitania in May 1915, killing 1,198, including 128 Americans. Between its Zeppelin and U-boat attacks, the German government helped shift American public opinion to the Allies, prompting leading newspapers such as the New York Herald to refer to the sinking of the Lusitania as wholesale murder, and the New York Times to compare the Germans to savages drunk with blood. Wilson already had justification for joining the Allies at that point, and had the United States done so, it might have shortened the war and short-circuited Russian communism. Certainly Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov Lenin, exiled in Switzerland when the war started, would have remained an insignificant figure in human history, not the mass murderer who directed the Red October Revolution in Russia. Instead, Wilson opted for the safe and cheap response. He demanded and secured German assurances that such atrocities would never be repeated. Although, within a few months, the Reichstag would formalize the policy of unrestricted submarine warfare, dooming the Sussex, a channel ferry, to torpedoing and the loss of another 50 passengers, including two more Americans. The president again issued strong protests, to which the Germans again responded by promising to behave. In truth, Erich Ludendorff, the industrial supremo who directed the U-boat campaign, had no intention of curtailing his effective submarine war, even less so after May 1916, when the outnumbered high seas fleet failed to break the blockade at Jutland. In a gigantic battle that pitted more than 100 German warships against more than 150 British vessels, some 6,000 British sailors were killed, and 2,500 German seamen went down. The German high seas fleet had engaged a force significantly larger than its own, inflicted more than twice as many casualties, and yet after the battle, German Admiral Reinhard Scheer informed the Kaiser that the surface fleet could not defeat the English. Only U-boats could shut down transatlantic trade. They continued to ignore previous promises made to Wilson. Few nations successfully maintain neutrality in large-scale conflagrations. Often, as with Switzerland or Sweden in World War II, a country does so successfully because it has little to offer either side or offers no significant advantage to either. Such was not the case with the United States, which, despite Wilson's proclaimed neutrality, could not possibly remain uninvolved. The American economy was disproportionately tied to the Allies, particularly Britain. And, as with the Napoleonic Wars, the nation with the most powerful navy dictates terms at sea, as did the British once again. Aside from repeating Jefferson's fiasco of an embargo, there were few options for Americans wishing to maintain economic ties with that part of Europe they could reach. But if the Germans were placed in an untenable position, they enthusiastically embraced U-boat warfare despite its risks. Many within the German Imperial Navy believed it would bring about the desired victory before the Americans would be drawn in, so there was blame enough to go around. Wilson used his so far successful efforts at neutrality as a campaign motif in 1916. With the slogan, "He kept us out of war," Wilson squeaked out an electoral victory in the November elections against the Republican Charles Evans Hughes, a former governor of New York who had the support of Teddy Roosevelt. In the Electoral College, Wilson won 277 to 254, although he enjoyed a wider popular vote margin of about 500,000. Americans wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt. Certainly, he received support from the peace movement, which was largely, though not entirely, sponsored by the Socialist Party, from whom Wilson drew large numbers of votes. Anti-war groups appeared, the American Union Against Militarism and the Women's Peace Party, for example, and some 1,500 women marched down Fifth Avenue in New York in August 1914 to protest against intervention. House Democrats broke away from the White House to block even modest preparations for war, and celebrities such as Jane Addams and Henry Ford publicly announced their opposition to involvement in Europe's fight. There was one small problem. the Germans would not cooperate. In October 1916, Kaiser Wilhelm celebrated the U-boat's feat of sinking 1 million tons of Allied shipping, and a week later, 5 Allied ships were torpedoed within sight of Nantucket Island. Only a few days before the election, a U-boat sank the British liner Marina. 6 Americans died. And then, in an act of astounding recklessness, the Germans sank the Lanao, a U.S. chartered vessel, off Portugal. Victories on the ground further bolstered the German outlook on the war, despite the fact that on the Western Front alone, men were dying at the rate of 3,000 per day, including, since 1914, 800,000 Germans. By late 1916, German or German-backed Austro-Hungarian forces controlled Serbia, Montenegro, and Galicia, had dismantled Romania, soundly thrashed the French army at Verdun, and turned back Allied offensives at the Somme, and occupied much of the western section of Russia. Moreover, the Austrians had dealt defeat after defeat to the Italians, who had come in on the side of the Allies. Under such circumstances, a little risk of offending the United States seemed harmless, especially since Wilson had not demonstrated that he was a man of action when it came to Germany. In December 1916, Wilson made yet another effort to mediate, issuing a peace note to the belligerents that first raised the prospect of a League of Nations that might preserve peace throughout the world. He also offended and irritated both sides by claiming that the United States was too proud to fight. For their part, the Germans had no intention of giving up territory they already held under any Wilsonian brokered agreement. And Germany rightly perceived that Russia was coming apart. It probably would not remain in the war much longer, in which case a France that was already bled white would, the Germans thought, offer little final resistance. Here again, Wilson's potential impact on the calculations of the warring parties was critical. Had Germany in 1915, or even 1916, seriously thought that several million American troops would replenish the French, the Germans might have come to the negotiating table sooner. Wilson's reluctance to fight over the just cause of the sinking of several American ships hardened rather than softened the foe. Sensing they could turn the war, the German leaders made 2 critical errors in January 1917. The first involved a resumption of the de facto policy of unrestricted submarine warfare. Now the Germans admitted publicly that U-boats would attack anything and everything at sea, belligerents, civilian vessels, neutrals. All shipping was fair game. Even if that brought the United States into the war, they reasoned, it would be over before American armies could mobilize and arrive in Europe. Perhaps the second error was an even greater blunder, in that it directly, if weakly, threatened Americans in the homeland. Noting that Pershing's expedition against Pancho Villa had soured relations between the United States and Mexico, the German foreign minister, Alfred von Zimmermann, sent a coded radio message to Carranza's government, essentially urging Mexico to declare war on America. In return, Germany would recognize Mexico's reconquest of Arizona, New Mexico, and other parts of the Southwest. British agents in London deciphered the code, showed it to an American diplomat, then forwarded it to the White House. Washington made the message public, generating the expected indignation. Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts knew immediately that the Zimmermann note would arouse the country more than any other event. Sensing that the public mood had shifted, Wilson issued an order authorizing the arming of merchant ships for self-protection, a symbolic act with no substance. After 7 more merchantmen went down, and following massive pro-war demonstrations in the nation's major cities, Wilson spoke to a special session of Congress on April 2nd. He asked for a declaration of war, laying out the unlawful attacks on American persons and property. That would have been enough. Congress would have given him the declaration, and matters would have been simple. Ever the idealist, however, Wilson drifted into grandiloquent terms, seeing the struggle as about making the world safe for democracy. It was of the utmost convenience that only a few weeks earlier, a revolution in Russia had dethroned the Tsar, for Wilson would have placed himself in the difficult position of explaining why, if America was fighting for democracy, the nation was allied with a near-feudal monarchy. Fortunately, the Russians had, temporarily as it turned out, established a constitutional democracy under Alexander Kerensky, giving Wilson the cover of philosophical consistency. The war fanned the righteous indignation of an aroused public even more through an intense propaganda campaign. American strategy, like Grant's 50 years earlier, involved wearing down the enemy with superior numbers and quality of arms. But superior numbers took a while to achieve, particularly given that the U.S. Army, even with the federalized National Guard, numbered only 210,000 men. There was no military draft in place, and the American high command had no specific strategy beyond training and shipping troops to Europe. The American economy, however, was a different animal. Already on a partial war footing in its support of Britain and France, the U.S. economy remained less centralized than the Germans and thus more flexible. The very nature of civilian control of the U.S. military, its demobilized force structure, and the American optimistic willingness to see negotiation and compromise as possible in the most impossible circumstances, all inhibited the quick and capricious use of armies and navies. Once Americans become convinced that force is the only option, however, they have proven that they can turn 180 degrees and implement it with wicked effectiveness. Flexing democracy's muscles. In spite of the nation's original neutral position, Wilson's strict neutrality in thought and deed, the administration now suddenly had to convince Americans that, in fact, one side was brutal and ruthless. Citizens who only a year earlier had been cautioned to curtail their anti-German feelings were now encouraged, openly and often, to indulge them. The government launched an all-out propaganda offensive, depicting the Germans in posters as the Hun, ape-like, fanged creatures wearing spiked German helmets and carrying off women. A culture sanitization occurred in which products or foods with Germanic or Teutonic-sounding names were replaced by American phrases. Hamburgers became Liberty sandwiches, and sauerkraut was called Liberty cabbage. Any identification with German culture was proscribed. Berlin, Iowa became Lincoln. Kaiser Street became Main Way. Germantown, Nebraska was renamed Garland. Hamburg Avenue in Brooklyn was changed to Wilson Avenue. And even the famous German Shepherd dog received a new name, the Alsatian Shepherd.